So can you hear me all? Yeah, so there's a microphone. Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thanks for coming, and sorry that I'm a bit late. I got into the wrong train. So this paper that I'm giving here, I actually gave last week at SAWAS, and it's really my attempt to chart my trajectories and dilemmas as both a feminist activist and academic, seeking to research, write, and talk about gender-based violence in relation to the Middle East. So more specifically, I will be drawing on research and activism in relation to Iraq, Turkey, as well as Lebanon, to map the discursive, political, and empirical challenges and complexities linked to scholarship and activism that is grounded in both feminist and anti-racist, anti-Islamophobic politics. Clearly, the way we as scholars, activists, write, talk about, analyze, and present gender-based violence in the Middle East and its diasporas is very much linked to our respective positionalities, which, while not determining our politics, do shape them and certainly influence that what we emphasize in our analysis and findings at any given moment. However, these positionalities might not only be shifting depending on whom we are addressing and when, but also in response to transformations in the prevailing discourses and analysis surrounding us. Moreover, based on my own experiences, I would also argue that specific empirical context with their different histories of oppression and resistance will also impact on the way we understand and conceptualize particular instances of gender-based violence and what we will emphasize and stress in our interpretations and presentations. Now, this paper presents an attempt to bridge and mediate between different approaches and positionalities, which are often perceived to be at loggerheads or in opposition, but are, in my view, all presenting a range of significant positions and approaches along a complex spectrum. So in the context of my research and activism in the context of Iraq, I have stressed the importance of historicizing gender-based violence to escape the presentism and myopic views that absolve a wide range of perpetrators, but also historical complicities and silences, as evident in contemporary representations of gender-based violence. In other words, thinking about contemporary Iraq, it is not all about ISIS or Daesh. The UK and US occupation, various previous Iraqi governments and their militia, insurgents and sectarian groups, armed gangs, and individual family members have all been perpetrators of the most vile forms of gender-based violence in Iraq, ranging from domestic violence, verbal and physical intimidation, sexual harassment, rape, forced marriage, trafficking, forced prostitution, female genital mutilation, and honor-based crimes, including killings. Meanwhile, Iraqi and Kurdish feminist activists who have been at the forefront of struggling against gender-based, but also other forms of violence linked to authoritarianism and sectarianism, point to the fact that international outrage about ISIS kidnapping, enslavement, forced marriages, rapes, and torture, specifically of Yazidi women, has neither translated into adequate material and political support, nor into asylum rights. Similarly, although this is being glossed over by many Iraqi feminists themselves, gender-based violence and other forms of atrocities have also been committed by Shia militia against Arab Sunnis. In recent years, I've increasingly recognized my own pitfalls and difficulties in talking about gender-based violence in Iraq. Refraining from contributing to either the sensationalizing and essentialist culturalist discourses so common in Western media and popular discourses on the one hand, and the taboo and silencing of gender-based violence within Iraqi domestic politics on the other hand, has been challenging. I have argued in the past that in practice the tension is often reduced to explanatory frameworks that firmly root violence within neo-colonial, imperialist, and neoliberal policies particularly those linked to the US and Israel. In other instances, activists and to a lesser extent academics, but most acutely the media and policymakers, restrictively reference national and local cultures and local manifestations of patriarchy as sources of gender-based inequalities and forms of oppression. And in this context, of course, culture is often conflated with religion, so it's sort of Islam that is often referenced. So it comes as no surprise that much of my scholarship and activism in Iraq has been motivated by the strong wish to write against the culturalization of gender-based violence in relation to the post-invasion context. The wider political and academic aim to challenge essentialized ideas of Middle Eastern exceptionalism and conflated notions of Muslim, Arab, Middle Eastern, and Iraqi culture has clearly been an ongoing and familiar incentive for many of us researching and writing on women and gender issues. Throughout my work and influenced by my former supervisor, Denise Condiotti, as well as other feminist scholars, I have stressed the importance of historicizing and employing a political economy approach when analyzing and presenting the increase in gender-based post-invasion Iraq. And here I would like to thank my colleague and friend, Nicola Pratt, with whom I've worked, of course, for many years on the post-invasion context. Clearly, the impact of the invasion and occupation on Iraq had to be central to Nicola's and my analysis of shifting gender norms and relations. More recently, however, I have felt a growing sense of discomfort with the tendency by some scholars and activists to solely focus on the ongoing impact of the invasion, which took place in 2003, and then, of course, the occupation following that for several years, as well as neoliberal economics, without recognizing not simply complicity, but proactive involvement of various local and regional actors. Obviously, these are linked and stand in dialectic, they're entangled, but as I would argue, they cannot be conflated. And I would like to stress here that blind spots are not merely the prerogative of Western scholars and activists. As we already know, in the context of many diasporic communities, radical, uncompromising positions and fervent nationalism can often be stronger if you're miles away and mobilize in relative safety. During the occupation of Iraq, for example, I was taken aback by many Iraqi diaspora activists who were actively supporting the increasingly sectarian insurgents who were involved in the killing of Iraqi civilians in their fight against occupation and imperialism more widely. Meanwhile, in post-invasion Iraq, the Kurdistan regional government has been far more proactive in reacting to pressures by women's rights activists than the central government in Baghdad. Kurdish women have been seeking state protection from the widespread gender-based violence that has also been prevalent in the Kurdish region of Iraq. Yet despite various legal reforms, women in Iraqi Kurdistan experience high levels of gender-based violence, particularly in terms of honor-based violence and female genital cutting, as the work of my former PhD student and now colleague Haja Kelly illustrates eloquently in her work. Domestic violence is rampant as well, but remains underreported and unprosecuted. Moreover, it is apparent that the Kurdish federal government has made instrumental use of gender issues to present itself as more democratic and progressive than the central government that has been a Shia Islamist and Arab-controlled central Iraqi government. And they've done that especially vis-a-vis the international donor and political community. Now, although women activists in Iraqi Kurdistan were far more successful than their counterparts in central and southern Iraq in influencing government legislation on gender issues, in practice, it emerged that the Kurdish regional government is interested neither in involving women in the executive nor in actually implementing legislation that is supposed to protect women from gender-based violence. Government officials argue that their priority has to be security and stability as opposed to women's rights. So in central and southern Iraq, as well as in the Kurdish region of Iraq, the impact of heightened and long-lasting militarization of society in conjunction with the continued and often growing significance of tribal affiliations, ethnic conflict, and widespread sectarian and religious extremism, have all contributed to a striking continuum of violence. The privileging of militarized masculinities, whether in acute conflict situations or at home, has developed side by side with the privileging of conservative gender norms and relations that stress women's honor and need for protection and control. Women's rights and gender norms have been used as bargaining chips, both vis-à-vis the international community to show a facade of egalitarianism and vis-à-vis a conservative tribal and religious authorities that were placated with more stringent controls and regulations. It is against this background of widespread gender-based violence across Iraq, but also my frustration with corruption and the adoption of neoliberal and neoconservative interpretations of women's rights and women's empowerment amongst many women's rights activists that I decided to shift focus for a while and engage in research on the Kurdish women's movement linked to the PKK, that is the Kurdistan Workers' Party. In 2015, I was desperately looking for a more hopeful context and wishing for more radical feminist politics than what I saw emerging in Iraq. At the time, this is still sort of early 2015, a peace process between the Turkish government and the Kurdish political movement was still active and looked promising. And I was intrigued by the apparent centrality of gender-based justice within the wider Kurdish political movement in Turkey and northern Syria, also known as Rojava. So I engaged in a joint research for a couple of years with a Turkish-Kurdish scholar, Latif Taş. And what we tried to do was to go beyond sensationalized or glorified discussions of Kurdish women's militancy and participation in armed resistance, while also recognizing the achievements made over the past decades. Against an exploration of the historical developments of both political ideology and mobilization, we have researched and analyzed the relationship between theory and practice in terms of gender-based equality and justice within both the armed units as well as the political legal movement linked to the PKK. At the time of actually engaging in empirical work amongst Kurdish women activists in southeastern Turkey, that was the late summer of 2015, the Turkish army and police had already started its recent systematic crackdown, destructions of towns and mass arrests of Kurdish activists, mayors and MPs. Our work on the Turkish-Kurdish conflict and the relationship between peace and feminist activism has forced me to rethink previous assumptions about the way local women's rights activists conceptualize violence in the context of wide-scale oppression, atrocities, and human rights abuses. Now, my readings and encounters with Palestinian academics and activists, as well as feminist colleagues I have contact with who work on Palestine, from that I know that we tend to stress the occupation and atrocities by the Israeli army, by the Israeli state, as the main explanatory framework, pushing back, and this is very important, pushing back against the international gender regime and UN apparatus emphasis on Palestinian culture, often also then conflated with sort of traditional and also Islam culture traditions and local forms of misogyny and gender-based discrimination. And I have to say, this is also what I expected to hear from the Kurdish women, because I thought there was sort of parallel in terms of Kurdish women experiencing violence and the Turkish state, systematic oppression by the Turkish state. Turkish women have not only been exposed to state violence for many decades, forms also of settler colonialism in southeastern Turkey, as well as marginalization and discrimination as second-class citizens. But they also had to endure the often patronizing attitude of Turkish feminists. Over the past three decades, Kurdish women's rights activists have had to systematically push back against the essentializing culturalization discourses of Turkish feminists, especially those of the older generation influenced by Kemalist, modernist, and nationalist narratives. as several Turkish and Kurdish activists I talked to stressed, honor-based killings and wider gender-based violence within Kurdish society have historically been represented by the Turkish state and Turkish feminists as a consequence of tribal culture, enabling the positioning of the state and military as modernizer and liberator who needs to intervene. Now, while clearly pointing to the structural inequalities and root causes of gender-based violence linked to the Turkish state, to my surprise, the Kurdish woman I talked to stressed the importance of not losing sight of the atrocities committed by their fellow Kurdish men, referring to patriarchy as a defining cause of ongoing instances of violence experienced by Kurdish women. So this is a picture that was actually taken in Diyarbakir. So Diyarbakir is the largest majority Kurdish town in southeastern Turkey. And the woman to the right is Gültan Kishanek, who was the co-mayor of Diyarbakir. And because Diyarbakir is such an important town in the Kurdish region, it's like she was almost like the leader of the Kurds in Turkey. And to the left is Ayla Akat, who is also known. She's a lawyer and a women's rights activist. Now, throughout our research in Turkey and the diaspora, that is in London and Berlin, with Kurdish women's rights activists, female fighters, mayors, and MPs, it became obvious that the struggle against gender-based inequalities and violence has become a core aim of the Kurdish political movement, integral to its struggle for cultural, political, legal, and economic rights. In fact, many women's rights activists told us that conflict exists not only between the Kurdish political movement and the Turkish state, but also between Kurdish women and men due to patriarchal authoritarianism. Ayla Akat Atta, for example, a prominent Kurdish women's rights activist and former HDP MP, stated in an interview in Diyarbakir in September 2015, "Our male comrades are also representing the power of the state. The freedom of women has to be a priority. There are four different articles in the Turkish constitution that we want to change. We could solve the Kurdish national cause in Turkey by addressing these four articles. But women's rights do not depend on changing articles in the constitution." So I found that, the Ayla Akat's statement, and I should say this was resonating with the views of most of the other women I talked to, runs counter to the historical and cross-cultural expectation that women's rights and gender-based claims tend to be sidelined for wider political claims pertaining to national struggle. In contrast, Ayla Atta and other activists that we interviewed link state power to male power. So struggling against the state also means struggling against male dominance and masculinist rule. Many of the women that I talked to stressed that they viewed the conflict with their Kurdish male comrades even as more challenging than the conflict with the state. Although I should say, we did the interviews in 2015 and 2016, and I suspect that the views have changed. Most of the women that we talked to are actually in prison. For instance, Ayla Akat and Gültan Kishanak. They have both been in prison now for almost 2 years, and many, many of the activists either had to flee the country or are in prison. So I suspect that they might not be saying this. But at the time, 2015, 2016, they were saying that, we are actually struggling more with our Kurdish male comrades than with the Turkish state. However, that might be changing. We found that many respondents in the diaspora also conceptualized conflict and violence not only in ethnic and political but also gender terms. A long-term feminist activist from Berlin involved in the Kurdish political movement and active in the progressive Kurdish-led but not Kurdish HDP argued in November 2015 that women make up 50% of society. And she said, I quote, "But in every society, even in Germany, we have witnessed violence and forms of inequality against women. It is a global disease. Even modern states have not managed to end this issue. In the context of the Turkish-Kurdish conflict, we have also witnessed that. with the effect of ethnic and religious conflict or civil war, violence against women increases. Women from all sides should come together to make peace. If we come together, if we refuse to send our sons and daughters to war for a political aim, then we can end both forms of violence together. Now, her articulation of the relationship between ethnic conflict, gender-based violence, and peace challenges the idea that gender-based violence is inherent in Kurdish, Turkish, or Muslim societies, but not in Western countries such as in Germany. No doubt, a diasporic positionality is extremely complex and challenging in the current climate of heightened Islamophobia, racism, anti-refugee and anti-immigration sentiments, and the rise of right-wing movements and constituencies in Europe and North America. Now, this became very apparent to me during a recent visit to Germany when I participated in a symposium in Berlin. The media featured numerous articles about gender-based violence amongst Muslim asylum seekers and refugees following the rape and killing of a 13-year-old German girl at the hands of a young Iraqi Kurdish man. The man, a failed asylum seeker, had fled back to northern Iraq, so the Kurdish region of Iraq, but was caught by the Kurdish authorities. Now, it's not the time and place to go into details about the debates and discussions, but what upset myself and many of my friends most was intervention. I mean, of course, most was upset that the girl was killed, clearly. But in terms of discussions, later on, particularly stood out was the intervention of a white German anthropologist, self-proclaimed feminist, who announced that this was to be expected given that the refugees came from patriarchal societies in which men hate women. Now, in a classic sweep of exceptionalism projected onto the MENA region, Germany became a patriarchy-free society, and Middle Eastern and North African culture became generalized and decentralized in terms of hatred for women. And this, of course, in the German context, has increased, very much in the public domain ever since the documented sexual harassment of women in Cologne on New Year's Eve of 2015-2016, outside the famous Cologne Cathedral. Most of the men, and this is documented, were men of migrant background, mainly from North Africa. And it has made it extremely tricky for feminist scholars and activists in Germany to talk about this, to challenge racism, Islamophobia, and gender-based violence simultaneously. And we have seen really strange alliances emerge. So we have seen alliances of feminist and right-wing anti-refugee and anti-migrant activist organizations. We have seen also the glossing over gender-based violence in the name of fighting against racism and Islamophobia. But I think it's important to stress that Germany today is also home to a growing number of progressive, informal and more formal networks and organizations, many founded by women of migrant background, who combine anti-racist and feminist positions in radical and creative ways. Now, what might appear to be a detour on my behalf is, of course, at the heart of the conundrum of diaspora activists and those of us scholars, activists based in Western contexts, having to challenge, fight, and resist the many different forms of racism and Islamophobia on a daily basis. It is also central to the tensions which emerged in recent years between scholars activists based in Western contexts and scholars activists being based in the MENA region. In what follows, I will highlight this tension in the specific context of the LGBTQ activist scene in Beirut, drawing on my involvement with the Beirut-based journal Kohol, a journal of body and gender research. Now, in my own talks and engagement with academics and activists, I have critically engaged with, while also occasionally having been at the receiving end of what might be coined polemically post-colonial feminist bashing. Here, I'm referring to a trend among some activists in the MENA region to strongly criticize and dismiss some feminist scholars based in Western, mainly US institutions, who systematically challenge US policies and prevalent media representations of the Middle East and Islam. This phenomenon while present across some feminist and LGBTQ activist communities in the region, is particularly articulated and widespread in Beirut, the site of a dynamic young feminist activist scene, including LGBT and queer feminists. Over the past years, I've been following debates and tensions within the LGBTQ movement as well as amongst queer feminists through my involvement as an advisory board member of the Beirut-based journal Kohol. Now, the journal was founded by a group of young queer feminist activists in Beirut who wanted to provide a platform to both young academics and activists to share their research and writings on gender and sexuality with reference to the Middle East, Southwest Asia, and North Africa. Throughout my involvement with Kohol, I was increasingly made aware of the way that LGBT activists, as well as queer feminists, felt beleaguered and under attack by local and regional conservative forces and constituencies, whether in the form of local politicians, religious authorities, or family members. Even before the rise of Daesh, ISIS, there seemed to be a widespread sense that the activists strongly perceived culture and religion to matter in their struggle and the various forms of discrimination and violence they were experiencing because of not fitting in with heteronormative ideals. As a substantial group of feminist activists, particularly in Lebanon and Egypt, are highly educated, read English, and have access to academic literature, many are aware of debates and theorizing in the broad field of gender studies, especially when it comes to literature directly relevant to the region. And while referring to some scholars and their writings with respect and at times admiration, there is frequently a sense that many feminist academics based outside the Middle East tend to overemphasize the effects of imperialism and neoliberalism at the expense of recognizing the role of local conservative social and religious forces and constituencies. The first time I was alerted to the tensions between Western-based academics and activists based in the MENA region was in a Gender in the Middle East postgraduate seminar at SOAS several years ago. One of our MA gender studies students, a very bright Lebanese queer feminist, Lynn Hashim, complained about Western-based post-colonial feminists allegedly being more concerned with challenging their own government policies than engaging with local and regional dynamics in relation to MENA. She was, of course, particularly thinking about Laila Abulugud's Do Muslim Women Need Saving, but was concerned about a wider trend. Although I disputed what I perceived to be a far too generalized, simplistic, and polarized representation of post-colonial feminist approaches and scholarship, and also pointed to the entanglement between Western interventions and local and regional developments and dynamics, her worries gave me reason to pause and reflect. And as I explained earlier, her concerns also overlapped with my own growing recognition of the significance of local and regional factors in shaping developments in Iraq, including increases in gender-based violence following the invasion in 2003. While my misgivings in relation to my own work and approaches with respect to Iraq prompted me to rethink and reshift focus, there appeared to be a correspondence between my reflections, which I had published in an article a couple of years ago, and that of the LGBT activist and queer feminist who stressed the importance of recognizing local and regional factors in creating an environment in which being gay or queer could be life-threatening, certainly carried the risk of being beaten up by the police, being abused in prison, arrested and detained. Yet, it soon became obvious to me that there were strong tensions and divisions amongst LGBTQ activists and that some strands of the movement were extremely problematic from my political standpoint. Aside from feeling uncomfortable with the identity politics that is central to much of the organized LGBT activism and the monopoly and hegemony of middle-class gay men within the movement, I also felt extremely uneasy about the political and financial ties to neoliberal and neoconservative bodies, especially linked to the US government. Particularly in Lebanon, some activism oriented towards sexual orientation and gender identities and expressions have shifted from grassroots organizing to formal organizations that are frequently funded by US institutions, which has contributed to a gradual recognition by the state in the Lebanese context. Many groups that were community and members-oriented adapted their leadership and worked to NGO-ized structures that are project-based or that focus on service provision. Biba Saik, our editor of Kohol, and myself have tried to intervene in current debates, which we found too polarized and simplistic. We felt it was necessary to distance ourselves from both the purist claim that grassroots or community organizing are more authentic and radical than formalized structures of work, and the neoliberal claim that service provision and funded projects are the only way possible of organizing on the ground. We wanted to question and challenge NGOization and the mainstreaming of LGBT rights and activism. With a deficit of transparency about funding that is systemic to NGOization, NGOs that monopolize regional human rights funding, particularly in Lebanon, tend to rely on funding sources that emanate from the same structures they historically positioned themselves against, such as imperialism and neoliberalism, hence obscuring a leftist history of LGBT movements. LGBT activism in general and gay rights NGOs in particular seem to be operating in a post-Mossad predicament. On the one hand, they insist that they are no agents of the West. While this claim is legitimate, it is considered to be a response to Joseph Massad, who in turn maintains that his critique of the corporatization of the gay agenda on a global scale is distorted and represented by gay rights activists as an attack on gay-identified individuals. Moreover, such a claim can only be understood vis-à-vis the production of an authentic counterpart which reproduces the same parameter of authentic versus agents that gay rights NGOs distance themselves from in the first place. Rejecting complicity with the West where identities are concerned is not a disavowal to complicity where neoliberalism and global local structures of power are concerned. Despite claims to the contrary, LGBT activisms led by middle-class gay men tend to isolate the struggles of migrants, women, trans, workers, and feminist activists, especially once they are able to lobby for wider recognition, tolerance, and respectability, such as in the Beirut context. Debates and tensions within the movement became particularly polarized during debates about Pride and the significance of the rainbow flag amongst LGBTQ activists in Beirut of May, in May of last year. Since 2005, activists in Lebanon have tried to commemorate Eid al-Adha, the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia and Biphobia, by raising the rainbow flag and organizing events linked to Pride. However, for the first time in 2017, Pride in Beirut, which was organized by a joint platform of Lebanese LGBTQ organizations, received backing by international funders, Lebanese businesses, and the mainstream media. A week of events and activities was advertised openly and with great enthusiasm, although several queer feminists criticized the commercialization, neoliberalization, and single-issue focus of Pride, given the way that migrant workers and refugees have been treated and exploited in Lebanon, evidently with the complicity and allegedly even direct involvement of some of the organizations involved in organizing Pride. Lynn Darwish, a longtime queer feminist activist, articulated her discomfort the following way, and I quote, "They use the rainbow flag and a pot of gold to draw us in and proceed to use our struggles to naturalize and instigate racialized violence and exploitation near us. This is called gay imperialism. It's a thing governments do. We should not fall for it. And yet, most NGOs take pots of gold from these embassies. Some of the newer NGOs have been known to profit of the oppressions of gay and trans people and are now speaking loudly in their names. They have million-dollar budgets. Why do we let this happen? What is the silence? We should research their work, ask them where they get their funds, ask them how their budgets are allocated, ask them about the sex exploitation rumors they're associated with." However, when threatened by religious constituencies, debates and tensions took a radical turn. Divided queer feminists and silenced any critique of the platform that organized Pride. The Muslim Ulama organization, which is a Sunni group of religious scholars, evidently with ties to extremist organizations like Al-Nusra and Daesh, issued a warning and ultimatum on Facebook and demanded that a major event of the Pride Week program was to be cancelled. The Mufti and other religious authorities also got involved and asked the Minister of Interior to intervene and close down the event to be held at a hotel in Beirut. When the hotel received threats, it decided to cancel the event. According to a report endorsed by the organizers of Pride, at 22:28 on May 13th, the Muslim Ulama organization issued a public acknowledgement of the collaboration they received from the Minister of Interior and the Director General of the General Security and thanked them for acting quickly to put an end to the event. The next day, they issued another statement laying out an action plan to combat deviancy in Lebanon in collaboration with government and religious authorities. Despite this apparent support by the minister and security, other events planned for the week went ahead. Yet the final event of the week had to be moved to a secure location after the organizers received a visit and warning from a security officer. While the threats and interference by the religious authorities and the collusion of government officials and security prompted a strong reaction from LGBTQ and feminist activists across the spectrum, only a small group of queer feminist activists continued to articulate their misgivings about the way Pride had been organized and conceived. The majority decided to back the Pride organizing platform unconditionally. As one queer feminist activist and researcher put it, "I prefer the rainbow flag over the ISIS flag. In fact, give me the US flag anytime over the ISIS flag." When I questioned in an exchange on Facebook why it would have to be an either-or, and also pointed out that US policies interventions have contributed to the emergence of the ISIS flag, my intervention was largely dismissed on the basis that I was a post-colonial feminist based in the West. Now, it would require a paper on its own to discuss and explore the multiple strands of tensions, miscommunication and actual differences along both academia and activism on the one hand, as well as MENA region location versus Western location and institutional affiliations. Here I would merely like to stress that in my view, and as many feminists have argued on numerous occasions, the binary of knowledge production and activism is problematic and glosses over the complex ways in which funding, privilege, and constructions of authenticity work. In the current context of crisis of higher education in places like the UK, for example, it might be much easier for an Iraqi women's rights activist to obtain funding for a research project than a British-based academic whose job might be on the line in the context of widespread university cuts and savings. This is not to deny the many privileges enjoyed by those of us inhabiting academia. Nor do I want to belittle the historical hierarchies of knowledge production, which have clearly favored academic settings, especially Western academic settings. At this point, however, I think it is necessary to complicate our ideas about privilege, hierarchies, and abilities to engage in knowledge production. Moreover, activists, whether based in the MENA region or in Western context, have substantially different experiences, aims, and approaches. And we know that feminist activists, even as specific as queer feminist activists, could be extremely divided and polarized in relation to specific issues. In the same vein, I would also challenge simplistic constructions of authentic regional versus Western, which glosses over substantial differences within geographical settings, as well as the intricate and shifting ways we are all positioned politically, institutionally, and personally. Many academics and activists based in the MENA region are Western educated or have been attending Western institutions in the region, for example. And I just to quickly inject here, I mean, a couple of years ago in my gender in the Middle East class, had a group, maybe 10 or 12 students of Middle East origin who kind of, that particular year, there was sort of a strong block and they were challenging the students, particularly white British, but also American students. Well, you know, why are you studying the Middle East? And you know, and we have the authentic knowledge about it. And I felt, you know, very uneasy about this. And I mean, I spent quite some time trying to unsettle the idea of privilege here, because out of the 10 or 12 students, most of them were there, the parents were paying their fees, while, I mean, many of the students in my class, the white British students, I know that there was a large group, first generation in university, and some of them were working two or three jobs to actually, you know, be able to go to university. So I think we have to sort of unsettle privilege as well. And again, this is not to unsettle historical and current power differences in terms of, you know, this part of the world and the Middle East. And what is often too casually referred to as Western academia, especially Western feminist scholarship, of course also consists of a wide range of different epistemological, methodological, and theoretical approaches on politics. Moreover, contemporary feminist scholarship produced in Western institutions is very much shaped by academics coming from elsewhere or having close personal, family, or political links to places outside North America and Europe. No doubt, violence and its multifarious sources, perpetrators, and forms of resistance are clearly manifest in our empirical realities. Yet as scholars and activists, we are not only engaged in the attempts to understand, analyze, challenge, and fight violence, but we also struggle with its representations. Representations of violence and scholarship in the media and popular culture, and crucially in policy discourses, reveal the complex and fraught ways our respective locations shape the registers we use to talk about and challenge violence against women and gender-based violence. We are collectively challenged to avoid dichotomous approaches in terms of the macro and micro power configurations that are constitutive of each other but can never be reduced to one or the other. An empirically grounded work might require us to shift our emphasis and preconceptions about gender-based violence, but in my view, we will still react to and feel compelled to engage with prevailing discourses and narratives that surround us. For example, my shifting emphasis in relation to Iraq has been rooted in both empirical realities on the ground linked to political developments over the past 15 years, but also my discomfort with prevailing narratives. While I initially felt compelled to challenge the racist culturalization discourses prevalent around the time of the invasion and occupation, I felt equally uncomfortable about the narrative of progressive leftist colleagues and activists who continue to blame everything on the US and Western interventions, even 15 years afterwards, and with the most corrupt, sectarian, and authoritarian political elite having played their role. In the context of the Turkish-Kurdish conflict, I was struck by the Kurdish woman activist's emphasis on Kurdish men and local forms of patriarchy as detrimental to Kurdish women. Clearly, it would have been very problematic for me to not recognize the structural inequalities and the various ways the Turkish state is actively involved in gender-based violence in relation to women in Turkey, including Kurdish women. But it would have equally been disrespectful and problematic to only stress the role of the Turkish state without recognizing the role of Kurdish men, including those in the Kurdish political movement, of reproducing inequalities and being complicit in various forms of gender-based violence. And I do not simply want to repeat my argument that we need to escape our straitjackets of positionality in order to avoid misleading dichotomous approaches. Being based in London, New York, or as I was in Berlin, and facing racist, Islamophobic, and imperialist media representations and policy discourses on a daily basis inevitably shapes the way we think and write as feminist scholars and activists. But crucially, this struggle should not become our only and even main point of reference if we want to take solidarity and resistance against gender-based violence seriously. As feminist activists and scholars, wherever based, we cannot avoid speaking simultaneously about corruption, political authoritarianism, sectarianism, the instrumentalization of culture and religion at local and regional levels, and various instances of what Denise Candiotti has coined masculinist restorations. Candiotti suggests that under conditions of neoliberalism, high male unemployment, and increasingly precarious labor and simultaneous increased aspirations and public presence of women, many states engage in crude means to maintain and reproduce patriarchy. Masculinist restorations refer to historically specific, regionally and locally configured processes and power configurations that contain authoritarianism, Islamism, and sectarianism, which all intersect with global structures pertaining to imperialism and neoliberal economics. Finally, my experiences in relation to LGBTQ activism and discourses in Beirut illustrate that polarized positions emerge not only amongst academics, but also activists. Spaces for critique and nuance shrink radically in the context of Islamic extremism, particularly since the emergence of ISIS. Expressions of discomfort or critique are easily dismissed as Western, academic, or theoretical, and detached from the political realities of struggle on the ground. Yet, I feel it is imperative academically, politically, and personally to continue to not only try to bridge our different ways of thinking, but also to conceptualize our various approaches and emphases in terms of a continuum rather than a fixed and insurmountable difference. The attempt to mediate and bridge requires us to recognize that our political positions, analysis, and ways of packaging our findings are linked to locations, contexts, particular histories of gender-based violence, as well as specific histories of resistance and struggle. At the same time as acknowledging that we all tend to react in critical manner to prevailing discourses and representations around us. This is not to fall back into some naive, we are all in it together mode, but to embrace complexity, nuance, and even ambivalence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicola, for a really stimulating talk. I'm going to ask Nicola now to say a few words. I won't say too much because I'm sure you've got a lot.